God,
God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anyone here tonight in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you. Clayton, I see your hand up.
Yes.
All right.
Yes, I have actually 2 full days
now. All right.
Welcome.
Glad you're here tonight, brother.
Yeah, I'm tired of being tired.
Yeah, me too.
In the right place.
Oh yeah, I know. I've been coming to these meetings for a while. I did have one year's worth of sobriety. But to make a long story short, I walked back in onto my porch after a year, and one day, a beautiful sunset, and I said, "I'm gonna have one drink. Can't hurt." Well, we know where that happened. But anyway. Nice to be here.
Welcome. I'm glad you're here.
Welcome.
All right. Anybody else? First 30 days? All right. Thank you. The preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous says that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we are very excited to have Blind Dave from Austin, Texas, come to tell his story tonight. And after he does that, somewhere around the top of the hour, we'll take a short break, call for announcements, pass the Seven Tradition basket, et cetera. And then we'll reconvene about the top of the hour to about 8:25, we'll have the opportunity to ask Dave some questions. So please think of some questions. Please send them to the user questions. And I've been looking forward to this all week. Dave, I don't want to take up another minute of your time, brother. Thank you for coming to share with us tonight.
Thanks for inviting me too. And hope y'all all had a Merry Christmas and hope you have a Happy New Year. I'm glad to see the guy here with 2 days. You know, there's an old guy, he's dead now, but he used to always say around this time of the year, he'd say, alcoholism is a threefold illness, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. So I know that we lose a lot of people who are not on strong footing at this time of year. So I'm glad that you're back with 2 days and not deciding to wait until after the New Year. You know, we don't always get to pick our sobriety date. It just seems like a moment of something happens where we have maybe the courage to take that step. But sometimes I would go to, I go regularly to certain treatment centers that I do, but I take people with me, sometimes sponsees or friends, and introduce them into trying to get to share a little more. And sometimes I'd have somebody, I'd say, so how long you been sober? And they'd say, well, I've been sober now for, 12 months. I said, what's your sobriety date? And every now and then somebody would say, I got sober on July 4th, you know, and then one guy got sober on New Year's Eve, another one got sober on Christmas Eve. And finally one day, I used to think, what, you couldn't have waited one more day? You know, that's a heck of a time to get sober. And finally I asked this guy, I said, so you couldn't have waited one more day? And he said, well, I didn't pick my sobriety date. He said, I just came to in the state hospital in a straitjacket, and it happened to be Christmas Eve. So that makes sense. You know, we don't get to pick our sobriety date. Sometimes it just sort of happens. And so I thought I felt my phone vibrate. Anyway, we'll get on with it. I'm glad you're here. I don't remember your name. Was it Chris? I can't remember. But anyway, glad you're here. So I'm Blind Dave. I am an alcoholic, and my sobriety date is July 9 of 98. So I am currently 22 years in this program without a drink. very thankful for my sobriety. My home group is the primary purpose group of Austin, and we meet on Tuesday nights. We have a Zoom meeting on Wednesday nights, and I don't get to go to, we used to have it on Tuesday when we weren't meeting in person, but we've started back up the in-person meeting, and so we moved the Zoom meeting to Wednesday, which I don't get to go to anymore because I have one of my treatment center commitments on Wednesday. So anyway, if you want to look it up, it's on Wednesday. It's a good meeting. So I was born in 1948. I was born legally blind, though I did have enough sight to begin public school. And I went to public school for the first, second grade. I could still read their books. I had to put my face right down on the book kind of to read it. They had to put my desk up right close to the blackboard so I could see what the teacher was writing on the blackboard. And what I remember about my first couple of years in public school was parent-teacher night, and my dad happened to go with my mom this time, and I remember him asking the teacher about little Dave. How's little Davey doing, you know? And the teacher said, well, you know, little Davey here, she said, you know, he's a special person. You know, he sure seems to exhibit leadership qualities. Oh, my dad was proud of that. Not really sure what she meant. But I do remember being out on the playground and me and a couple of other boys was throwing mud clods at some of the girls who were playing jump rope. And the teacher saw us do that. And she called us together and sent the three of us to the principal's office. So here we are marching into the principal's office. And I was a little bitty kid. I was still 4'9" when I began the sixth grade. I was 4'11" when I started the seventh grade. And so I was always a little dude. Somewhere about in the eighth grade, I think I shot up from 4'11" to 5'6" in the eighth grade, and then I quit growing. But anyway, we're marching into the principal's office. And so I've got these two other kids on each side of me, and I come up to about their shoulders. And I remember as we're going in the building from the playground, I looked up at them two boys and I said, y'all keep your mouth shut. I do the talking. And that's kind of the way that I guess I still sort of am a little bit. I know that I was not about to put my life in their hands. You know, I'm not going to put my life in someone else's hands. So y'all keep your mouth shut. I do the talking. By the end of the second grade, I couldn't read their book anymore. So in the third grade, they got me some large print books. I got through the third grade. Then I couldn't read large print anymore. And so the day came when my folks had to put me on the bus and send me from Houston to Austin to go to the state blind school. Now, what's interesting about being in a boarding school, they have very strict rules. And I don't do very good in those kind of environments because they're very rigid. And when I hit puberty, things got really bad. So I spent a lot of time in the principal's office. And I remember sitting in the principal's office again, waiting for the principal to come into the office. And it crossed my mind what I think that teacher meant when she said, I seem to be a good leader. I think what she was trying to tell my dad was that I'm a terrible follower. And I don't do good with lots of rules, particularly if I think they're stupid rules. So I got through junior high at the blind school. I got expelled once. My parents talked them into letting me come back the next year. And I lasted a couple of more months and they kicked me out again. And they told my parents, do not send him back. So I went back to Houston and had to figure out how to go to public school. And all my childhood, my mother is a very devout Christian lady, which meant that I had to get up every Sunday and go to church as a kid. And I hated that because I could hear my friends outside playing, but I had to go to church. And so when I came back home at the end of junior high and I'm living back at home again, I remember that Sunday morning, mother came in and said, I got your pants pressed, got your shirt ironed, everything's all laid out, get ready for church. And I said, I'm not going. She said, what? And I'm braced for the fight, you know. And I said, I've decided I'm old enough to decide for myself on this issue. And I've decided I'm not going to church anymore. And there was no fight. Mother just started to cry. And she walked out of my room. Left me feeling weird. I wasn't expecting that. I love my mother. It was the first time I've ever made her cry. But as time passed, it sure proved not to be the last time. I entered high school in 1965, proclaimed myself to be an atheist. I was fed up with that stuff. And I became very defiant against that authority also. And we had a lot of religious kids in my, we had some religious kids in my high school. And since I was so outspoken about my opinion on that, I became their target. And I was frequently into debates or arguments, and I would attack those kids ferociously, with ferocity, you know, and sometimes I could tell they were wishing they hadn't even brought the subject up. Mostly I was just rude and had a bad attitude. But I remember one kid one time, he's backed away from me. I'm sure he thought lightning was going to strike me any moment. And he said, "You're going to go to hell." I said, "And to hell with you, and to hell with your God." Another thing that happened in high school was I met this girl, and her parents were serious drinkers, and they didn't seem to mind that we drank with them. Oh, that was real cool. So I got to try to just go over to their house on weekends and hung out with her family. And we drank all weekend long. That's, you know, I just got out of that boarding school with tight rules, and now I'm free. And her mother would pick us up on Friday, and we'd walk out of school, hop in the car, and her mother had the ice chest in the back seat all iced down. Well, I'd pop a top before we was off the campus, man. And we drank all weekend long. And she dropped me back off at school Monday morning, usually with some kind of hangover, you know. And I graduated in 1968. Something that happened right after graduation, I went to this rock concert one night. And we're standing in the ticket line waiting for them to let us in. And here come the Jesus freaks passing, you know, they come down the line passing out their literature. And I did what I always do, man. I went on my attack and with the usual ferocity. And the crowd of people that was in that ticket line circled around me and were just listening. And they began to cheer for me. I was really proud of myself. I knew Madeline Murray O'Hare would have been proud to have called me her son, because I was just as rude as she was. And so this was all going on back in the 60s. Y'all know what else was happening back then. There was a lot of other stuff out on the street that you could mix with your drinking too. And I've done all of those. I read where Bill Wilson said, then the doctor came and began to administer heavy sedatives. He said, next day found me doing both gin and sedatives. This combination soon landed me on the rocks, and maybe it was the combination, I don't know, but by the age of 24, I was hitting a hard bottom. I already had 7 friends since high school. 5 years out of high school, I had several friends that were dead. And I was burning to the ground. But I just did what the big book says. I continued to blot out the consciousness of my intolerable situation the best I could. And I guess just ride it to the bitter end. But one day I stand out in front of my apartment, and this guy who is my new neighbor, he came over to introduce himself to us, to me. I was just out there by myself. And, you know, we talked a few minutes, and then he tried to turn the conversation toward God, found out he was one of them Christian people. And he tried to turn the conversation toward God, and I went on my attack. And for the first time in my life, I lit into this dude and bounced off of him. Man, this dude pulled a Bible right out of his pocket. I never met one of those kind. And he was able to flip through that Bible and counter all my arguments. But what was most amazing was the spirit in which he did it. He was not hostile at all. He just commanded a presence of God and authority. And he cracked my shell. And, you know, he would share his faith with me. He'd see me now and then out in front, and he'd always stop and talk. He was a nice guy. And sometimes he'd mingle a little bit of his sharing of how he, you know, found God. And it took him a couple of months, but he told me he thought God might help me. And after a couple of months, I came to believe that. And I never will forget the day that I kneeled down to give my life to God. I got up from that prayer a different person. I poured out all my booze and threw away all my stash and felt freed from my obsession. I had a very powerful third step experience. But what does the big book say we must do immediately following the third step? The fourth step, a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves to remove the things that block us. It says, though our third step decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Well, I didn't do any of that. None of them, my neighbor and none of his church friends knew anything beyond step three, other than go to church and praise the Lord and be thankful that you're saved. And I did that. I went off to church with him and his, you know, got all these new friends, and I could shout hallelujah just as loud as anybody. I also do a little music, and before long I was up there on the stage, part of the worship team. And before long after that, I was in charge of the worship team. And I studied my Bible hard. I eventually became a deacon in the church. And sometimes if the pastor was out of town, he'd let me fill in and preach for him. And then I started getting invitations to come to other churches as a guest speaker. Then I went off to East Texas and started a little church out in the country, and tried my hand at being a pastor for a few years. Man, I tell you, I learned how to do church. But the big book says, without having done that inventory work, that what we do not learn is enough humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense we find it necessary. We who? That's right, you and me. We find it particularly necessary to achieve and maintain a certain level of humility. And church did not give me that. In fact, it seemed to be a place where I could climb the ladder of success. And I was trying to do that. So sure enough, without having done any steps beyond step three, right in the peak of my climbing the ladder of success in the ministry, the day came when I had this thought that said, you know, I really think my problem was mostly drugs. I don't think there'd be a problem if I have a drink now and then. So starting with the idea that I just have a drink now and then, I resumed the progression of alcoholism. And again, the big book says, more than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. So sure enough, the day came when I found myself preaching with a hangover. And for almost 25 years, teaching and preaching the Bible with a hangover became the recurring theme of my life. Each time I hit a new bottom, I'd change brands of religion. I'd think there's something wrong with our theology in this bunch. And the other group down the road swore they had more power. So I changed churches, and I think this new brand of religion is going to fix me. And for a while, I'd seem to be fixed. For a while. Until the next relapse. And, you know, but I would always eventually hit another bottom, and I'd crawl back into church and sober back up. But I just couldn't sustain it. So during one of those, every time I sobered back up though, you know, just like most alcoholics, every time I sobered back up, I thought, I've got it now. I've got it now. And so during one of those times when I thought I had it all figured out and it was time for me to leave town, I moved from Houston to Austin. I had a friend that had just given his life to the Lord up here, and we used to do music together back in the day. And so we was going to start a little music ministry. So I moved up here to Austin, and we started doing blues. I love blues. I like to sing blues. I play harmonica a little bit. He's a really good blues guitar player. And we started just singing about Jesus with our blues. and out on the street here downtown in the music district, you know. Then wintertime came and we thought we needed to go inside, so we started looking at open mic opportunities. That clubs have open mic night, and we'd go in there and play. Well, one time we was in this place playing our music, and we come down and this girl came over to our table, introduced herself to us, and she had a little thing going with God. Well, I was new to Austin, and I just started kind of a little home group that was, you know, in a living room, a few of us getting together, and I was trying to get something started here in Austin. And so I invited her to that, and she showed up. Found out she was in AA. Wow. I was surprised when I learned that AA was a spiritual program. And I just dug AA people. And so sometimes she always came to my little thing on Sunday evening, but sometimes on Saturday, I'd go to an open AA meeting with her. I just loved AA people. But of course, I don't need AA right now. I've got mine figured out, you know. And so me and her became very good friends, and we'd see each other on weekends. And after about a year and a half, me and her got married. Now, I really got to know a lot of her AA friends. And some of them would now and then come to my little Sunday evening home church thing. And for a time, all went well. Until that inevitable day that always comes around, that I thought had been long enough now that I could probably be safe to have a drink. And I started that little snowball rolling down the mountain again. And it's growing. It's about to become an avalanche. And I'm living a double life again. And I was trying really hard to control it. I was trying to keep the worst of it hid. And I was doing a pretty good job of keeping the worst of it a secret, which in my mind meant I was controlling it, right? I mean, if you're not getting caught, you're controlling it. But it was aggravating the heck out of me to have to do that. You know, I didn't have a problem drinking. I had a problem with people who think I have a problem drinking. One day I was sitting in an AA meeting with my wife, and I'm frustrated to the max. And I could no longer sneak enough to satisfy me. I was wishing she'd go off for the weekend on one of her AA retreats. And I was just feeling irritated and mad at the world in general, and mad at all these people around me in specific. And I was puffed up like a toad, and had my arms folded across my chest, you know. And this guy happened to read from the big book that day. He said, most of us have been unwilling to admit that we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. And he closed the book and he said, here's the earmark of an alcoholic. He said, if you are controlling your drinking, you're not happy about it. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. And he said, this is the earmark of an alcoholic. If you're controlling your drinking, you're not happy about it. Whoa, that hit me right between the eyes. I thought alcoholics couldn't control their drinking. No, they might control their drinking, but they can't be happy controlling their drinking. And I left that meeting wondering. And I remember I said to my wife, I said, honey, I know you're worrying about my drinking a little bit. And I said, to tell you the truth, I'm worrying about it some myself. But I just want to put your heart at ease. I realize this, and I'm going to start praying about it. She said, what are you going to do different? And I felt like that was a trick question or something. I knew she asked me a question that I really didn't know the answer to. And she said, you know, Dave, if you're thinking about drinking, or if you're thinking about not drinking, either way, you're thinking about drinking. I went, oh, God. you just encapsulated the last 25 years of my life. And something clicked. The trap snapped and I was caught. But, you know, that posed a little problem for me, because I'd heard y'all talk about this fearless humility and this rigorous honesty. And that poses a little problem for a little preacher who has quite a secret life. I talked to one of the old men around her AA club, and he was able to help me find the courage and walk into that meeting and announce to my wife's friends, many of who had been to my little Sunday church, and to say, my name is Dave and I'm an alcoholic. That was step one for me, and it hurt. But at least I did it, I admitted it, it was step one, and I opened my heart a little to Alcoholics Anonymous. You say, what do you mean a little, Dave? Well, I'm still very ashamed that my Christian faith had not healed me of alcoholism. I'm very embarrassed that I've got to ask AA for help. So I felt like it was my duty to show y'all I didn't need much help. Well, what does that mean, Dave? Aren't you going to get a sponsor? No, I don't think I need one of those. Well, are you going to work the steps? No, I don't think I need to do that. Well, what are you going to do? Well, I'll go to some of y'all's meetings, you know, and say, my name is Dave and I'm an alcoholic, you know, and minimal participation, of course. I only intended to get about ankle deep into AA, and then me and the church can work out the rest of it. I still had a lot of religious pride. You know, Bill Wilson wrote, he said, we represent no particular faith or denomination. We are dealing only with general principles common to most denominations. So I thought, well, then why can't I just do it in church? And step two, what about this thing? Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I came to believe 25 years ago. And have not been able to stay completely sober. I don't know how to come to believe all over again. I'm not going to change my God. I still have my same Lord and Savior, as we say in church. I'm not willing to change any of that. I don't know how to come to believe all over again. And what about this word sanity? Are they saying that I'm insane? Well, as I read the big book, I discovered that it talks about the moment of insanity that precedes the first drink. And then I'd hear people talk about that in the meeting and put it into perspective for me. I'd go, oh, is that what's been happening? You know, and I'd read more of the big book. And then I'd hear y'all talk about it in the meetings and put it into perspective for me. I'd go, oh, I see. And I begin to see me in the big book. And one day I'm sitting in a meeting having another one of these aha moments, you know, when I realized I'd had my step two experience. I suddenly came to believe that the same God that I had had for 25 years, who had not been able to keep me sober in church, was now going to speak to me in the language of the big book through the voice of other alcoholics. And I was going to hear my same old God in a brand new way. I came to believe that God does something very unique for alcoholics through alcoholics, in a way that he can't quite accomplish the same thing for us somewhere else. So I was able to open my heart fully to AA at that time. So made a decision to turn my will and life over to the care of God. And what I now understood, that was for me, the alcoholic, the care of God for me was mostly going to come through AA. And that I had to submit myself to that very unique work that God does for alcoholics through alcoholics. And I was willing to ask someone to be my sponsor and let him help me. And step three goes on to say, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We have a new employer. Being all powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. I knew what that meant. I knew that step three was asking me to make a commitment that I would stay active in AA to help other alcoholics to get sober and carry on that unique work that God does for alcoholics through alcoholics. And I balked at step three. I thought, wait, I wasn't going to make this my number one commitment. I mean, I thought I had a ministry in church, you know, and I wasn't planning to stay here and hang around here. I said, God, surely you don't think helping another alcoholic achieve sobriety is more important than preaching the gospel of eternal life. And God said, no. But I have people who can do that better than you, Dave. But they can't do this. And you're an alcoholic. I need you to serve me here. So then I was able to make the commitment to make my single purpose to stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. I became willing to commit and carry on that unique work that God does for alcoholics, through alcoholics. It took a full surrender for me. Yeah, first I had to be willing to come, then I had to become willing to stay. The big book says a fellowship has grown up among us, of which it is a wonderful thing to feel a part. And I can tell you that sobriety for an alcoholic is not wonderful unless you're a part of a people who have a vision and a purpose-driven sobriety. You know, I remember, I knew the Bible said, without a vision, the people perish. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic. So I want to talk just a little bit about the vision of Alcoholics Anonymous, because we're told that we must carry that vision every day. The preamble says that, you know, we are not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. We do not wish to engage in any controversy. We neither endorse nor oppose any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. That is the vision of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I caught it. I like to say in AA, the Lord made a blind man see. You know, I mean, I caught this vision. So I'm going to talk a little bit about it because it's in a vision for you. That's why they call it that. That's why they call that chapter that. It says, we have shown how we got out from under. You say, yes, I am willing, but am I to be consigned to a life where I shall be stupid, boring, and glum like some righteous people I see? I know I must get along without liquor, but how can I? Have you a sufficient substitute? Yes. There is a substitute, and it is vastly more than that. It is the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, great. That's it, huh? I'm going to give up my party life for this wonderful substitute of going to meetings, huh? That's it. You know, I heard this old timer say one time to a new drunk, he said, son, we got good news and we got bad news for you. He said, the good news is that there is a solution. He said, the bad news is we're it. You know, we're one of the largest fellowships on the planet that no one wants to join. So what do they mean by it's vastly more than that? I probably have to understand a little bit about the vision of Alcoholics Anonymous and how we came, how it became our vision. I'm going to talk a little bit about the origin of AA and why they can say it's vastly more than just a substitute. We know in chapter two that Roland Hazard went to Carl Jung, you know, to try to solve his drinking problem, and he failed. And returning to the doctor, he asked him point blank why he couldn't stay sober. And the doctor said, you're apparently what we call a chronic alcoholic. I've personally never seen one recover. The man felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. He said, are there no exceptions, doc? And he said, well, actually, there are. Here and there, once in a while, it has been reported that an alcoholic has had what's called a vital spiritual experience. Maybe you could find one of those. Well, there was a hot spiritual movement going on at the time called the Oxford Movement. And Roland came back to the States and he got in the Oxford group and he had that spiritual experience and he got sober. And I believe he was from Vermont, and he went and got his friend, Ebby Thatcher, and brought him into the program, and Ebby got sober. And Ebby had a friend in New York, Bill Wilson. And while he was down in New York, he went and visited Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson got sober. And then Bill Wilson, when he was down in Akron one day, he led Dr. Bob to get sober. So that's the early history of how this thing came to be. In the foreword to the second edition, it says this: the spark that flared to become the first AA group was struck in Akron, Ohio in June of 1935 during a meeting between a New York stockbroker and an Akron physician. And we know that's Bill and Bob, right? Okay, so the spark that flared to become the first AA group was struck in Akron, Ohio during a talk between a New York stockbroker and an Akron physician. The question is, why was it Akron? Why was the first spark of AA with Bill and Bob in Akron? Why wasn't it one of those other things like Roland in the Oxford group up there in Vermont? How come it first spark of AA wasn't between Ebby and Bill in New York? Why do they say the first spark of AA was in Akron, Ohio, between Bill and Bob? Did you know Ebby always carried a resentment that he was not considered the co-founder of AA? That resentment was part of why he couldn't stay sober. And I heard an old tape, very scratchy, with Ebby one day. And he said on that tape, he said, "They say AA started in Akron. I still say it started in New York." He was still pissed about it. And I know people in AA. I've even listened to AA historians talk about this thing about why wasn't Ebby the co-founder of AA. And he said, "I still wonder why he's not." There's people in AA today that wonder why wasn't Ebby the co-founder. Well, there's a reason for that. So when we understand what that reason is, we might understand what they mean by saying AA is vastly more than just a fellowship. Back around, I don't know, 2000, 2001, there was this historian, AA historian, that had run into this old man. It was 98 years old at the time, and he claimed that he was in the Oxford group with Bill and Bob back in the day, and he actually was. He stayed in the Oxford group. He was one, but he knew Bill and Bob, and so this historian was bringing him around and letting we would have he'd come to towns and you could go visit this old man and talk to him about the early days of AA. And he said, you know, Bill would come into our Oxford meetings and say, "You got any alcoholics I can work with today?" And he said, we had to kind of put him in check about that. We said, "Bill, we don't just work with alcoholics." See, the Oxford group was a church. They felt like they had to save the world. Churches believe they're supposed to save the world, you know? But Bill kept wanting to look for alcoholics, and they had to kind of slap his hand about that. And in fact, they said, "You're a businessman. Your outreach ministry ought to be to businessmen." But they couldn't jar Bill Wilson loose from this idea of working with alcoholics. He said, one day Bill Wilson took the few alcoholics we had, and they eventually left the Oxford group and started their own thing. And he said, "I think it's because in the Oxford group, we preached against all sin and even smoking." He said, "And I think Bill left the Oxford group because he didn't want to quit smoking." Everybody laughed, thought that was funny. But I don't think that's the reason. So let's, in Bill's story, it says this. Ebby came to him that day, and Bill pushed a drink, and Ebby pushed it back. And Bill said, "What's this, Ebby?" He said, "Well, I got religion." And Bill went, "I was aghast." So that was it. Last summer, now I call it crackpot. Now I guess he's a little cracked about religion. And Bill's defenses were up. And finally, Ebby said, "Bill, why don't you just choose your own conception of God?" His defenses went down. He said, "That statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I'd lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning." Scales of Pride and Prejudice fell from my eyes and a new world came into view. But then Bill said that he began to show signs of delirium tremens. So treatment seemed wise. So he checked into the hospital. And he says, there I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him, to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away, root and branch. He said, my schoolmate visited me and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiency. We made a list of people I'd hurt or toward whom I felt resentment. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for strength and direction to meet my problem as he would have me. My friend promised, he said, these were revolutionary and drastic proposals. But the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric, he said. He said, my friend promised that when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my creator and would have the elements of a way of living, which answered all my problems. Now that's a big part of Bill's story y'all are familiar with, but Bill had a very big spiritual awakening after doing the steps. He said, while I lay in the hospital, the thought came. Now, I believe if the thought came, the thought was sent. And he said, the thought came that there must be thousands of hopeless alcoholics who would be glad to have what had been so freely given to me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They might in turn help others. He says, my wife and I abandon ourselves with enthusiasm. I like that word, enthusiasm. Are you enthused about your sobriety? Well, here's why. Bill is enthused. My wife and I abandon ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping other alcoholics find a solution to their problem. And it tells in the foreword there, the second edition, it goes on to say that Bill Wilson worked hard with other alcoholics for 6 months before he ever went down to Akron. He got none of them sober. But he worked hard. The spark that flared to become the first AA group was struck in Akron, Ohio, during a talk between a New York stockbroker and an Akron physician. 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of his alcohol obsession following a meeting with an alcoholic friend who was in the Oxford group of those days. Prior to his journey to Akron, the broker had worked hard with alcoholics on the theory that only an alcoholic can help another alcoholic. Where did Bill get that theory? Ebby didn't give it to him. The Oxford group didn't give it to nobody. In fact, they kind of slapped Bill's hands about that. I think Bill had a theory. It was a hunch when he had that spiritual awakening. And he had that thought that came that there might be thousands of hopeless. Maybe I could help some. And he apparently had a little bit of a theory that nobody could help an alcoholic like another alcoholic. And so Bill hit the street working on that, but he got nobody sober. And he sort of became depressed about that. It says, but he had succeeded only in keeping sober himself. Well, why was that? Why was he having any success? I think he was still kind of trying that, like Ebby did. I got religion, and he was coming real hard like an evangelist or something. I don't know, but Bill became very discouraged that he was not having any luck. He stopped by to see Dr. Silkworth, who said, you might need to start talking about the hopelessness of alcoholism first and lay down a good foundation about that hopelessness. Bill went on to the house, and Lois noticed he was kind of depressed about it a little bit. And she said, what's the matter, Bill? And he said, I thought there'd be thousands, and I haven't got anybody sober yet. And Lois said, well, Bill, at least it's kept you sober. And another piece of theory came to light in Bill's head. He realized that helping others, working with others, seemed to be a vital part of him staying sober. You know, there's something about that I need you as much as you need me. that I am as dependent upon you as you are me, that puts me in a certain place of humility. And that humility is vitally important for an alcoholic. I am not the knight on a shining steed here to save you. I realize that we do this together. And Bill needed to realize that dependence. So the broker had gone to Akron on a business venture, which had broke down, which bogged down completely, and leaving him greatly in fear that he might start drinking again. And we know the story in the Mayflower Hotel, where he was on shaky ground for a few moments there. And he says he suddenly realized that in order to save himself, do you hear the difference? He used to look for alcoholics to save. Now he's looking for an alcoholic to save himself. He finally got the humility he needed. And we know how the story led him to Dr. Bob. And he's slipping away toward that bar there in the Mayflower. And it's pulling his thoughts in that direction. And he says, what about my responsibilities? I used to have those thoughts. What about when I don't show up for work tomorrow? Well, how long did it take me to come up with what I was going to say for why I didn't show up to work tomorrow? Not long. What about his family? Oh, yeah, I used to have those thoughts, too. What am I going to tell the wife when I don't come home tonight? I don't know. I'll think of something. And then he says, what about those other alcoholics who will not be able to get well because you will not be there to help them? Where did that voice come from? He said, oh, yes, those other alcoholics. I'll bet there's a bunch in this town. And I read that and I said, oh, yes, those other alcoholics. What other alcoholics, Bill? You hadn't got any yet. You hadn't got one yet. What do you mean those other? What other alcoholics? Those that he saw in his vision when he laid on the hospital bed there. And he said, the thought came. There must be thousands. Perhaps I could help some of them. They in turn might help others. And right here in this moment that AA hung by a thread, Bill said, those other alcoholics, I'll bet there's some in this town. And that pulled in, I think God hit that button. I think God installs a button in us if we catch the vision of this program as we should. And that in times like that, God is able to hit that button and caused me to go, what about my sponsees? What about my AA group? I don't want to let them down. I've had that many times, particularly after any kind of a relapse dream. It's always followed by, oh my God, what about these other alcoholics? He suddenly realized that in order to save himself, he must carry his message to another alcoholic. That alcoholic turned out to be the Akron physician. This physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means to solve his drinking dilemma, but had failed. Did you know that Dr. Bob was in the Oxford group for 2 years and was not managing to get sober? Same program that Bill had been in for 6 months. But Dr. Bob was a lone drunk in church, just like me. I know there was other drunks in that church, but we didn't know each other. And we definitely weren't hanging together with any vision of helping other alcoholics. Now, I wasn't doing that in church. I was trying to save the world. And that don't work for an alcoholic. I did. In a sense, even though I was in a crowd of people, I went to a big church. We had like 10,000 people, but I was a lone alcoholic with a secret. And so was Dr. Bob. But when the broker brought him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness, the physician began to pursue his spiritual remedy with the willingness he'd never before been able to muster. He sobered never to drink again up to the moment of his death in 1950. This seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect another as no non-alcoholic could. It also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, is vital to permanent recovery. So there are two equal parts to our singleness of purpose. That we stay sober to help another alcoholic achieve sobriety. We stay sober by helping another alcoholic achieve sobriety. And that it, our single purpose has two parts. And so the theory, Bill's theory was proven when he finally felt in order to save himself, he must carry his message to another alcoholic. And Dr. Bob, who had been trying it in church and one not succeeding, when another alcoholic brought the message to him, he got it. And a spark flared. And it became the first spark of what is AA today. A vision was born. It's our single purpose. And it was given to us. It's a divine thing that was given to AA. And Bill Wilson was the first person to catch that theory. He caught it in two different parts. It was completed and first tested on Dr. Bob. That was the first spark of what is AA today. Hence, these two men set to work almost frantically upon alcoholics arriving in the Akron City Hospital. And that was not the Oxford Group vision, not at all. This work continued through the summer of 1935. When the broker returned home in the fall of 1935, a second small group promptly took shape in New York. Whoa, promptly? I mean, he'd been trying it for 6 months before he left with no luck. But a second small group promptly took shape when he returned. How come? Well, because now he's got the complete vision, our complete primary purpose, our singleness of purpose. And not until he had both parts of that in his vision that the spark flared to become the first AA group. Life would take on new meaning, it says, to watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see the fellowship grow up about you. This is an experience you must not miss. Frequent contact with newcomers and with frequent contact with each other and with newcomers is the bright spot of our life. You see it flare right there? The bright spot of our life. It just ignited right there. And I must carry, every day is a day, and I must carry this vision. I must not get any bright ideas of what I can do without y'all or what I can do instead of y'all or how I can replace that. It does not work for me. I've tried it for 25 years. But that spark ignited in my heart just like it did with Bill Wilson's. I'm so grateful today that I've caught the vision of Alcoholics Anonymous. And because it says he and his wife abandoned themselves with enthusiasm to this idea. And that spark has flared in me to become a passion for serving God in this fellowship, this unique fellowship. It seems that the sparks of God happen the best from one alcoholic to another in a way that they can't happen for us somewhere else. I'm not bashing church at all. I'm just saying that there's something unique about alcoholics pulling together to stay sober for a common purpose and being a part of the whole. In this situation, it is very true that the whole is equal to more than the sum of its parts. And that's because God is in it in a way that we have not been able to find him quite the same anywhere else. So thank y'all for letting me share all that, and I'll let it go for there.
Oh, Dave, that was amazing. Thank you so much. I'm going to unmute, allow people to unmute and say thank you.
Thank you, David. Spot on, man.
Thank you so much. That was incredible.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Yeah, you're quite welcome. David. Thank you all for having me come.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Thank you. It was a joy.
Thank you for your vision.
Thank you. Yeah, that's what it is.
Very much.
Thank you much.
All right, I'm going to grab it back. We're going to give Dave a moment or two to exhale. And I'm going to encourage everybody to send your questions. Dave's very generous with his time. He's going to stick around for another 25 minutes or so and answer any questions. But the questions that he's going to answer are the questions that you submit. So you see the user questions. That's really Larry. Please use the chat and send your questions in. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supported, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district and area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. Are there any announcements tonight for the good of AA? Seeing none. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Also, the chat is available if anybody wants to leave their number publicly. If you're shy, also, you can send an email to info@simpleactions.net. So, Dave, I actually muted you. Were you able to unmute yourself? While we resume, I'm going to check over here and see some questions. We need those questions, guys. Dave, that was amazing. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
I've got a question here. You know, I one thing that I was thinking about, like you talked about the third step and the beautiful talk on AA history. What was that first, fourth, fifth step like for you?
The first fifth step for me, it was interesting because I probably was like many people on my fifth step. I kept back one thing. I thought surely everybody has something they're not going to tell, you know? And so I called my sponsor and told him on Friday, I said, I'm ready to do my fifth step. And he said, well, I've just put my house on the market. I'm really busy, going to be showing the house over the weekend. He said, how about we meet over at the club on Monday and we'll go in the back room and do your fifth step. And I said, sure, no problem. But that left me all weekend hearing a voice in my head. And I know it was God using y'all's voice saying, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. We beg of you, be fearless and thorough from the very start. And I thought, okay. So on Sunday night, I wrote down on my little Braille paper that one more thing. And poof, this little buddy popped up and said, don't worry, he can't read that. And I thought, that's right, he can't. And I can back out the last minute if I decide to. So sure enough, on Monday, I'll go through the into the club. I go in the back room and I'm thinking, ain't no way I'm going to tell him that. And we sat down. I got out my papers and he said, just a minute, Dave. And he took my hand and he said, God, I think you better help Dave be fearless and thorough from the very start. And I don't know why that was a God moment for me. It startled me that he said what I'd been hearing in my head all weekend. And I thought, is he reading my mind? Or perhaps he telepathically sent me that message. I that was when I began to think, this ain't church. This dude's reading my mail. And I realized, because I mean, I've talked to pastors and I've talked to Christian psychiatrists, and I felt like I could dance circles around them and slip right through the cracks. And this guy nailed me. And that's when I realized once again that God does something very unique for alcoholics through alcoholics. I've been, you know, in my beginning, I had to be reminded of that several times, that this ain't church. Mm. This is the sparks of God that happen from one alcoholic to another in a way that it don't happen somewhere else.
All right. Thank you. I have another question here. What is your favorite thing about sponsorship?
The very thing that we're talking about, it fires me up. I think every time I work, take somebody through the steps, every session I come out of the back room and I am on a bigger high than they are. I think my wife can attest for that. I mean, I'm glowing from working with them, and I find such a joy. I was sharing with some one of the treatment groups that I've been talking to, and I said, you know, used to, one of my biggest thrills was to meet some insanely drunk chick that you can carry home and she'll wake up tomorrow and wish she hadn't have done it, but right now she is a target. That was a big thing, you know. But now my biggest thrill is to help somebody that is that pitiful to get their feet on a spiritual path. There's no feeling like it to help another alcoholic. And that's what I like about AA. It has put me into a very unique experience called Alcoholics Anonymous. And when they said, yes, we have a substitute, it's vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not talking about the social aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous, although that's true. The big thing is the spiritual, us all being united as one big collective spiritual experience. And I get to be a part of giving and receiving in that context. That's what it says. It's the bright spot of our life.
Oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Has your prayer and meditation practice changed since joining AA?
Absolutely. I never did any kind of an evening review all my Christian days. I was never taught anything about inventory, and I was never taught anything about amends, and I was never taught anything about continuing to take personal inventory and continuing to set right any new mistakes. I never did any of that in church. I could do my confession just to God real quietly in my closet, and nobody else had to know. So my meditation time, I have two meditations, and this is my favorite topic to teach in a workshop, is step 11 and the two meditations. It says in step 3 that God is all powerful and will provide what we need if we keep close to him and perform his work well. And that's a contract. I usually teach that as a contract. In church, we call it a covenant, which is a sacred contract. And this is a sacred contract between me and God. And my whole program is that, to experience the power of God as I practice keeping close to him and performing his work well. And there's nothing else in the contract. That's it. It doesn't say if I do this and this and this. There's only one end in there. It's if I do keep close to him, which is inventory, and perform his work well, which is help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. And so when I get to step 11, it says it'd be easy to be vague about this matter of, you know, prayer and meditation. We believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. And it makes two. They're definite, which means clearly defined. There's no question about what they are. So don't do something else and say you're doing this, because you're not. There's nothing wrong with doing other forms of meditation if you like them, but don't say you're doing this. And later on, it says, if you belong to a religious body that requires a definite morning devotion, you may attend to that also. And also does not mean instead of. And so I must do these two meditations. And when we retire at night, the first one is keeping close to him. It's inventory. In fact, in step 11, inventory has now become a meditation. And it's the most important part of my spiritual connection to God. That's why it's first on the list. Didn't you ever wonder why it's going to give us a 24-hour design for living, and it starts out with when we retire at night? Ain't that weird? Why don't it start out with when we wake up in the morning as we go through the day, when we retire at night? But it's not. It's when we retire at night, when we wake up in the morning, and as we go through the day. And that's the divine order. And that's because God enters the voice of God, because the purpose of the program is for God to become my director. And so he becomes my director through the work of inventory. The most important thing for God to teach me is when is ego creeping back into my life. The most important thing for God to teach me is not how's the stock market doing, or how's it going to be doing tomorrow. God is my director, because the book says we learned we needed to change ourselves to meet conditions. It ain't about conditions. It's about me. And my nightly inventory keeps a check on me and my attitude. And if my attitude is right with God, everything else will fall into place. And the next morning meditation is on awakening. And it says, we ask God to divorce us from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives, that he may employ our mental faculties. And if God's my employer, and if he's given me a specific job to do, then my morning meditation must be on that job. And that job is for me to carry this message. And the biggest part of my morning meditation today is big book open in my lap. And I remember when I started treating my morning, my reading as a meditation. And it says, ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. That inventory is where the voice of God enters into my life. And it spills over into my morning meditation while I'm reading. And I started getting some good inspirations while I was reading. And I'd share those in meetings. And people would say, man, I like what you're sharing, you know. And I'd say, one day I thought, I better start writing some of this down before I forget it. So I got me a little notepad and set it right there by my big book. And that morning I got up and I sat down with my big book with a new enthusiasm. It's like, I'm going to start looking for inspirations and writing them down rather than just enjoy them for a day. And so I made sure I had my writing material there, and I almost felt God say, oh, are you going to take notes? Well, then get ready, because here it comes. And if I can just get my attitude right about this serving God well and take it serious, God takes me serious. And so my morning meditation is largely that. I do my morning prayer, of course, but then I get up and get my book. And I got my notebook there, too, to take notes. So anyway, My meditations have totally changed today. They're around keeping close to him and performing his work well. Did you know that it says that our book is meant to be suggestive only? We realize we know only a little. Did you know that at the end of writing the big book, they said it was only a little of what God has to say? God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. And that's what God wants to do in your morning meditation, is teach you the book and teach you how to expand upon it and expound upon it and help others get it. God has a lot he wants to say about the book. And he'll really take you serious if you'll start getting serious about writing down the things he shares with you. Anyway.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You said, that for a while you were just going to meetings. Can you talk a little more about why meetings alone didn't work for you?
I guess because there's not enough humility in it. Because for me, it all comes around to keeping that alcohol ego in check. And I came into AA with religious pride. And I want you to know that my pride ran rampant in church. Like I said, it wasn't long till I was up on the stage. It wasn't long till I was in charge of the worship team. It wasn't long till people was telling me what a great person I was. And then I started filling in preaching. And I felt like I was making some room, some ground there. And when I came into AA, I thought, man, and particularly because a lot of my wife's friends had been to my little Sunday Bible study. And I couldn't swallow that pride to go in there and say, I need your help. I thought I'd came there to help them find something better than AA. And it was really hard for me to have to humble myself to that degree. So for the first, I didn't pick up any chips. I didn't get a desire chip, a 30-day, 60-day. I didn't pick up no chip. I wasn't going to get that involved. I'm going to show y'all that I've got something better, and I don't need a lot of AA. I just need to admit I'm an alcoholic and realize that I need to kind of stay here to remember that. And I made 9.5 months and with nothing. And me and my wife went out to eat one night, and the girl set us down at a table and said, can I start you out with something to drink, sir? And my mouth started watering. And I hate the obsession. Every time it ever shows up, fighting with it is torture, and you always lose eventually. It'll wear you down. And here it came. And I knew that it was inevitable that I was going to drink again, because I can't withstand that's riding you forever. And I felt it coming back. And I thought, oh my God, I guess maybe I am going to have to get a sponsor and work the steps, because I've been hearing them say you can't stay sober on just the fellowship. Someone said that the steps is the rite of passage into the real AA. And I had decided that was true, that I wasn't really in AA. I was just pretending.
Do you have any defects of character that keep showing up? And you can share whatever you're comfortable with about what you do about them.
Well, the biggest defect of character that shows up that I catch a lot is dishonesty. Dishonesty can come so simply. Sometimes it's not in what you say as much as in what you didn't say that you kept hid. And sometimes I have to call, did you know that I've been sober 22 years, and just a few months ago, about 2 months ago, while doing my inventory, and it was another check, 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 perfect inventory. But see, you get to know the voice of God when you do inventory as a meditation. And so sometimes while I'm doing that nightly review, just out of the blue, God will say, call so-and-so tomorrow and check on him. Well, what's that got to do with my inventory? Nothing, except that I am in communion with God when I kneel down and say, God, I'm ready to be corrected. The Bible says, if we shall judge ourselves, we shall not be judged. And there's a humility in kneeling down, even if it's been a good day. I don't think there's anything I need to check. It's easy to go to bed thinking, hey, it's been a good day. I don't need to do an inventory. But I've learned I do it anyway, because I might miss out on something God's going to say while I'm doing that inventory. And I always get, when I review my day, what I come out of it with, always, after I review my day, I realize the things I've got to be thankful for, and I get up and write a gratitude list. Bill said the inventory shouldn't always be red ink, and so my gratitude list is the good stuff of today that I'm grateful for, and I always come out of that review by realizing the people I have been in conversation with, phone calls, meeting, whatever, that go on a prayer list. And what I'm looking for mostly in my prayer, in my inventory, is who to pray for, maybe who I need to check on, and what I've got to be grateful. And I don't remember what the question was. Oh, character defects. And sometimes God will just, when it says, are you keeping something to yourself which should be discussed with another person at once? And I think, no, I don't feel like that. But I feel God say, call your sponsor anyway. You haven't talked to him in a while. I need to hear that. I can get too independent. And I have to watch for that. It's still the same old ego. I can get too independent. And then recently God brought up something that was on my fifth step. In fact, it was the thing I didn't want to say. And he said, call your sponsor and give him some more details. You scanned over the top of that pretty shallow. He said, call your sponsor and give him some more details on that. And I went, oh God, 22 years later, and I got to go back to that and be a little more descriptive. So it's always the ego, and it comes sometimes in what I don't want to tell you.
Thank you. So I got a question here that says, how can I cope with triggers in early sobriety? I know we've got plenty of people here who are brand new, and maybe we're talking about the obsession of the mind, being reminded of things, but being early in sobriety and maybe being thirsty.
Well, new in sobriety, my biggest trigger is sobriety. Alcoholics don't do sober. An alcoholic, if you've crossed that line, when you're not drinking, you're suffering the other part of alcoholism, the growing restless, irritable, and discontent until you can't stand it anymore and you go drink. So everything can be a trigger. In fact, you can nail down all your triggers and try to avoid them, and something else will pop up as a brand new trigger. I mean, you know, you can't just know this, that being sober, I need to be connected to God, and that's my only defense. And until then, I have a limited amount of time that I can cling on to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and just keep myself surrounded with them. Whatever you do, we're talking about this because it's, you know, someone said alcoholism is a threefold illness. I might have said that earlier. I might have been in the other meeting. Alcoholism is a threefold illness: Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. And so watch out for going to parties and stuff. Just don't go. Or try to go with other AA people. And it's, I know it's a bummer right now that we're all shut in and all this stuff. But I must realize that I cannot do this without God. And I must get God into my consciousness every means possible. And praying is one. Reading is another one, AA literature, and talking to other alcoholics. Avoiding triggers on its own don't work, because if I don't have some kind of a spiritual thing going on here, then I can start off saying, I don't want to go do this or that, it's a trigger. But before long, I'll start wanting to go do this or that. And, you know, I think it's funny when someone says, I told my sponsees to call me before you drink. Well, my problem is that if I'm about to drink, I ain't going to call you. Why would I call you if I'm thinking about drinking? I can't let myself get that far down, you know, into it. I'm not going to call. I need to stay close. First of all, I want to say a prayer for whoever. Do they mind if you say what the question is? Who wrote the question?
I just have the question, Dave. I don't know who it's from.
Okay. Well, whoever you sent in that question, I want you to bow your head for a moment. Dear God, I pray that you would help this person get through this holiday season. I pray that you would, just as Bill caught a vision, I pray that you would help this person catch the vision and the fire of what AA has to offer, and that he would want that more than anything else. Keep him sober through this season, dear God. Amen.
Amen. I got one I think is right up your alley here. It starts with a quote, and then there's a question. The quote is, common sense thus becomes uncommon sense. What does that mean?
Well, it does kind of sound funny, but it means that it makes more sense to say it the other way around, that uncommon sense or thinking on a higher plane becomes our normal sense. So common sense, for us, our common sense becomes what is unnatural or uncommon sense compared to other people. And I believe that very much. It's the element of the God factor, the inspiration. Where it says our thinking will be on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. If you're climb up a tower, you can see a little further off. And I think this spiritual thing gives us a new perspective. And we just see life. We see a bigger picture of life. I like what it says in the 12 and 12, where it says, perhaps one of the greatest rewards of meditation and prayer is the sense of belonging that comes to us. And I thought, belonging to what? It says, we no longer live in a completely hostile world. We're no longer lost and frightened and purposeless. It says, I'm no longer live in a completely hostile world. I'm not limited to that thinking. I've gained a higher perspective. I'm kind of up in the watchtower. I see a bigger picture. And so we're no longer lost and frightened and purposeless, and we're no longer deeply disturbed by all the seeming evidence to the contrary, which surrounds us in purely human terms. We're no longer thinking in purely human terms. So I think that's what common sense becomes uncommon sense.
Thank you. We are running short of time, but we got a few questions. Have you ever experienced a resentment toward God? And do you have any suggestions for people who do?
Well, I never have, but I know people who do. And it's just a matter of my perspective is a little off. One of the things I tell people when I do the fifth step, I'll say that the deep, dark secret part of the fifth step. I say, now there's, I'm not afraid of anything in my past, as long as it's over and done and I live through it. I'm only afraid of my future because it holds the fear of the unknown. And I'm not afraid of it, to tell you anything. You know, I'm not afraid of the past unless it is something that might still pop up in my future. It might come back around to bite me in the butt. I'm afraid of that. And maybe some of these things are big enough things that I'm kind of ashamed to tell. So I'm just living alone with this fear and this secret. And I'll say, if you'll put that on the table in the light before God and one other person, then where it says, we ask his protection and care with complete abandon. I learned that God's protection and care are not two different things. They are heads and tails of one coin. And that one coin is called the grace of God. And God can protect me from that coming back to harm me. Or if it did come back to harm me, he can show me that he can care for me through it and help me get through it with dignity and with grace. And I say, but in order for you to qualify for God's protection and care, you have to be willing to put that in the light before God and one other person. And then if it comes around to bite you in the ass, it's not because God has abandoned you. So don't doubt that. Another thing I say, you may have some secrets that that you're not afraid will ever come back around to catch up with you. Nobody who knows what you did is still living or don't have any idea where you are. And you sleep at night not worrying that they'll ever find you. And I said, but now you're coming in day A. You can't stay sober. You got to find a God of your own understanding. And you're thinking, uh-oh. Well, nobody else knows about this, but God does. And you may have some things that you believe that God won't forgive you for. And this is the opportunity that if you'll put that in the light before God and one other person, God will call it even. And if you get out into the future and you start going through a bad part of life or a downturn, things get going rough, if you haven't got this cleared up, you'll start thinking God has come to collect, and he ain't letting you get away with it. And you'll actually think God is your problem. You might get angry at God because you think he's the problem. But I tell them that if you ever get in a place in life where life seems to just be bad and not treating you right, if you do this fifth step right, don't ever think God is the problem, because you've got squared away with God right there. And God is in your corner when life starts being unfair. God is in your corner. And I must not ever doubt that. I did have a time before I got into AA where I thought God was my problem, because I went on a really bad drunk that when my whole world caved in, I lost my ministry and everything. And I decided that I had been such a failure that even God was mad at me and just threw me away. I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't believe that. I begged God and begged God for a year to make it stop. And I finally decided that God was just so fed up with my failure that he had just left me and wasn't coming back. But I haven't felt that since I've done a fifth step. And since I didn't keep that one secret. So thanks.
Oh, thank you so much. Can I tap you for 1 minute on one question? Any suggestions for someone starting steps 8 and 9?
Yes. I don't know anybody who teaches this but me, but it's there. And if you look on page 79, it says, although these reparations take innumerable forms, there are some general principles which we find guiding. Now, remember, learning for God to become my director is what it says. It's the how and why of the program. And there's a process for me to get there. And this is a big part of the process. And now after step 5, it says we may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. It says we feel the nearness of our creator. And so after step 5, I do start feeling that nearness of my creator, like me and God are, we've shaken hands, we're on the same team, and I feel that. But here is where one of the promises is that we will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. This intuitiveness thing. This common sense becoming uncommon sense, this starting to get to know the voice of God. It's all about ego deflation. Step 5 was enough ego deflation to feel the nearness of my creator. But step 9 tells me that if I can humble myself and go through this process, I did my fifth step in a couple of hours. Step 9 took some time. Can you hold yourself to the fire with that much willingness until you're done? If you can bring that much willingness to the table, then you're in a position of your attitude that you can not only feel the nearness of your creator, but you can begin to hear his voice. Feel it. God's voice has no sound. You learn to feel it, but you know what it's saying. And it says right here, reminding ourselves that we've decided to go to any lengths to find the spiritual experience. And it's talking about this very experience of God becoming my director. It says we ask for strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences might be. We may lose our position, our reputation, or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. I have to be that willing if I want to feel the voice of God. The greatest thing the program that anybody can ever have is to be connected to the voice of God and to hear it when you need to. So I've got a list of names is all I've got here at step 8. And when my sponsees say, well, who do you think I ought to do first? I go, don't ask me, ask God. Well, what do you think I ought to say? Well, don't ask me, ask God. This is your chance to ask God these questions. the voice of God always starts with him helping me make amends. It says that in step 11. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. This is where God is first willing to start talking to me. And so don't miss out on that. Take your list of names and sit down with them and get quiet before God and say, you know, ask God your questions and write it down. Ask him what do you think you ought to say. When do you think you ought to go? Should I approach him at work, give a phone call? Should I write him a letter or go knock on their door? Ask God all them questions and you'll feel him answer. And it starts here in step 9. So, but now I do tell my sponsees, come and tell me what you think he said. Yeah. <I learned.
laughs> Sorry.
Yeah. But I'm not going to give them those answers. I'll check. And you know what? Sometimes I'll say, well, what if you said it this way? Maybe change a word or two. And sometimes they go, I like that. That's a good idea. But I have had a time or two where someone would say, no, Dave, I think I need to leave it the way it is. And I say, then by all means, you do what you think God's telling you to do, because I am not your God. And I don't have the right to try to misdirect you from what you think. Even if what you're doing may be a mistake, it's better than you abandoning what you thought God told you to say and do what I said, if you don't believe that's correct. And God will not let your mistake be a devastating mistake. But you abandoning what God told you to do what I said, could be a mistake, even if my idea was better. It's important for you to find and do the will of your own creator, it says in the 12 and 12. And so I want people I make sure they start practicing that at step 9, listening and writing down what you think God's saying. And I tell them this, I say, just a paragraph, that's it. Prepare your script. Let God be a part. And I say, when it's finished, you come back tomorrow and reread it. And because sometimes you need to back away from it for a minute and come back and look at it and say, ooh, I think I need to change this word. And you'll finally get it to where you know it's right. It's just like receiving an inspiration and interpreting it is just like feeling an inspiration for a song or a poem. And you start writing and then you read it. And then you go, wait, I need to change this. And then and it's a process of learning to discern an inspiration and put the words on it. Because inspiration don't have words. You put the words on it. And you're trying to match the words with what you're feeling. And sometimes that's a process. And with practice, I can get to where I'm quicker on discerning God's voice. And step 9 that's the big part of step 9. It's where I learned that process.
Oh, thank you so much. I didn't want that to end. Dave, you're so generous coming to share with us tonight. I want to thank everyone who participated. After the Lord's Prayer, we'll have an opportunity to thank Dave one more time. That was absolutely amazing. If I share my screen, could I ask somebody to just jump in and read the last three paragraphs on 164, please?
I can do it. My name's BJ. I'm an alcoholic.
Thank you, BJ.
Thank you so much, Dave. That was super powerful. Really appreciate it. A Vision for You, big book. This is taken from page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Amen.
Thank you.
All right, let's all virtually circle up and have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Oh, Dave, you cracked my heart wide open, brother.
Oh, man, I had a good time. I want you to know that I really appreciated y'all letting me come in here and be a part of this evening with y'all.
Thank you so much for coming.
Yeah. Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you for your share. Thank you for your spirit.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, y'all, I only get to experience that when I'm with y'all doing this. And so that's why it's a treat to me, too.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. This was awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Norma, for sharing him with us.
Sure. I can't keep him to myself. He's too special.
Aw, you both are.
Wait, did you get any phone numbers, sir?
Yes. You want to put it in the chat thing or something? My phone
Your
number?
Phone number?
Oh. Clayton, also, did you get phone numbers?
Oh, he was saying to the...
Oh, the new guy. Okay. Okay, yeah.
Oh, you ran him off, Scott.
I tried.
Thanks for thinking of him, Scott.
Hopefully he'll be back tomorrow.
Yeah, I do too. Does any of y'all know him?
No, he said some. You know him, Ebony?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, he said
the noon meeting.
Okay, right on. Yeah. He said somebody recommended that he come here. He Dave, he did have the opportunity to get at least a half a dozen men's numbers. They were posted in the chat.
Okay, to him.
I enjoyed watching Debbie enjoy Dave's share. Debbie has a very responsive face, and she is nodding and smiling and responding the whole time. I couldn't see everybody, but
yeah.
You know, the Zoom thing, every now and then I'm thinking, I wonder if anybody's there. Because, you know, I've had it drop out on me one time, and I did the whole rest of the hour. I just went on, you know. And then I thought nobody was there. And I called them. I said, when did it drop out? And they said, about halfway. So I think of that all the time.
I was at a treatment center goes to every week. They called Dave and they said, would you come to this treatment center Zoom meeting? And, you know, I usually sit here nearby if it's, you know, an invitation like this. So, because, you know, that's a weekly thing. It usually doesn't do that, but you never know.
Right.
Hopefully the needed power is there, as they say.
I usually remember that I forgot to unmute myself when I laugh at something that the speaker said. And then I interrupt them with my raucous laughter.
You know, I used to always open with a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I was going to record myself, when everybody started laughing, I'd turn on the recorder because I'm going to start talking right after that. So a lot of my talks that were recorded started off by you hearing everybody laughing. But when we started this Zoom thing, man, I'd tell a joke and it's like, no sound.
Yeah, yeah.
That's just a bad way to start off. Is to
get
a response. It's like, whoa, I'm going to quit telling a joke. That's not the joke anymore.
I really liked Threefold Illness, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's.
Yeah. BJ has a fantastic laugh.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Good material.
Yeah, good deal. Well, I hope y'all all have a great New Year's. Can I tell my New Year's joke?
Yes,
please.
As far as we're concerned.
So do you know the difference between a stack of old tires and a trash can full of used condoms? Well, one is a symbol of good year, of course. The other one is a symbol of a damn good year.
Lord. Very good. Now with I see I permission.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Well, hope springs eternal.
Yeah.
Okay. I think I'll stop the recording now.
Yeah.